This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. This week, after Theresa May called a surprise election, I'll be asking who the British voters actually are and how their choice will affect Britain's future. We voted last June on the question of the EU. We vote this June on who should take us out. The nature of the result could define British political life for decades to come.
This is the snap election to end them all, isn't it? In terms of possible results, the permutations, it's absolutely breathtaking. And the next 6 weeks are going to be deeply, deeply absorbing.
The general election will be the fourth major electoral event in the UK in as many years, following the Scottish referendum in 2014, the general election in 2015, and, of course, the EU referendum 10 months ago.
Every vote for the Conservatives will mean we can stick to our plan for a stronger Britain and take the right long-term decisions for a more secure future.
Mrs May's pitch is, who do you trust to guide us through the Brexit straits? The leader of the opposition's is, we need to smash the rigged system.
It is these rules that have allowed a cosy cartel to rig the system in favour of a few powerful and wealthy individuals and corporations.
Tonight in the briefing room, I'll be trying to find out who the British electorate are now, whether the old rules of politics still apply, and what the election means for the Britain of the future. First, this election is unusual, a sudden, unexpected national vote. Can snap elections from history provide some clue as to the nature and direction of the upcoming campaign? Lord Hennessy is one of Britain's leading constitutional historians and was in the briefing room earlier.
Snap election means unexpected. It means it's out of sync, or the anticipated sync. There were two in 1910 because the House of Lords was blocking the finance legislation of the Liberal government. So it became a peers versus the people election, the second election in 1910. But difficulty for the Liberal government, it produced almost exactly the same result as the first election in 1910 had. So it didn't settle anything, really, although the House of Lords did in the end concede, and the Parliament Act 1911 curbed their powers forever. There was a snap election in 1923 because Stanley Baldwin, being an honourable chap, wanted to change his economic policy from free trade to protection, and he hadn't put that to the British people in the previous election, so he called a snap election in December 23, and he lost, in the sense that he lost his majority. He was still presiding over the largest party by a big margin, but it was felt that Labour should have a go. And it was interesting, that one, because it marked the moment when the Liberals really were removed once and for all as the main centre-left opposition, and Labour began its slow climb to be the mainstream centre-left opposition. But there was another snap election which really bit hard into Labour's core. In 1931, Ramsay MacDonald had formed the first minority Labour government in 24, but that had fallen inside a year. And in 31, with the world economic crisis, his cabinet couldn't agree cuts, and it foundered. And there was an election with Ramsay MacDonald running on a national ticket.
I appeal to you at this election to return a body of men of all parties, united in serving the national interests, and give them power.
And Labour was reduced to 52 seats, to a tiny, tiny opposition. And there were only a small number of Labour figures in the national government. It was Conservative dominated. 74 is the nearest parallel we've got to what we're now facing. Ted Heath was embroiled in a great dispute with the miners, and it was the second miners' strike in 2 years.
If we wanted to, we could wipe the floor with these people. They don't know that.
We don't want to be violent, but if the police are going to be violent, then we certainly would be violent. And everyone knows what violence means when the miners start to be violent.
And the miners looked like they were going to drive a coach and horses through Ted Heath's incomes policy, which was the centre of his economic policy. So he went to the country with the Who Rules general election.
The issue before you is a simple one. Do you want a strong government which has clear authority for the future to take the decisions which will be needed? It is time for you to say to the extremists, we've had enough.
And the wide expectation, including me, if I remember, was that he'd get an enhanced majority. He already had a majority of about 40. In fact, he didn't get a majority at all. He got a higher proportion of the votes cast than Labour, but Labour got a small number of seats extra to the Conservatives' total. So it was messily hung. And so, as I think one of Ted's cabinet ministers put it later, Ted asked the country who rules, and the country replied, well, we thought you were. That many people didn't think it was necessary to have an election, and that's always the risk with snap elections. If you have too many within a short time frame, people get very jaded. And the other risk that was palpable in 74, and the experience of 74 bit deep into subsequent political generations, is it's impossible to have a general election on one big question. Because general elections are like quantum physics. They're a mixture of waves and particles. The particles are the little bits, although they can be very important. And the waves are the big, big questions. Now, Mrs. May's single-issue question is about having a sufficient level of stability in Westminster to get her Brexit negotiation through both Houses of Parliament.
Division in Westminster will risk our ability to make a success of Brexit, and it will cause damaging uncertainty and instability to the country. So we need a general election, and we need one now.
And this looks like being presented as a wave election rather than a particle one, but of course it's bound to be both, because that's the nature of politics. And also, this one is fascinating because it's bumping and grinding two forms of democracy. One is representative democracy, which is what we're most familiar with, which Westminster enshrines, which is MPs are elected individually in constituencies with party labels. But when you put that alongside referendums, which in the trade are known as plebiscitary democracy, it doesn't sit well because they're single issue and they're usually focused on a question that the government of the day can't answer or doesn't want to answer off its own bat. So you have two different electoral ecologies, and this election is a percussive effect of last year's EU referendum. So it adds a different flavour, a different piquancy to it. And on top of all that, as if that wasn't enough, you've got the question of the kingdom. We've got the Scottish question already brought alive by Mrs. Sturgeon wanting a second referendum, and the Scottish representation in Westminster, the fight there will be on the Scottish separation question. It's bound to be. There'll be other factors as well. But the SNP will want to come back with a predominant number of MPs again, and they may well. The knock-on effect could well be a Scottish separation in the early 2020s. So our very existence of a United Kingdom, as we've known it since the beginning of the 18th century, is all bound up with this as well. And there's one other question too. Could it mark the end or the beginning of the end of what I would call the standard model of British politics, which since my breathing lifetime, that's the 1950 election till now, has been a competition at election time between two things, liberal capitalism, represented by the Conservatives, social democracy represented by Labour. Liberal capitalism, to my mind, being the best system mankind has yet produced for economic growth and innovation, and social democracy the best for sensible redistribution. And most of the time, the British electorate has voted for a mixture of each, and that's what Westminster and Whitehall exist to provide. Now, that could go if Labour comes down to substantially lower than 200 seats. It will not be a viable opposition in terms of physical presence in the chamber of the House of Commons. And so the standard model will be distorted. It won't be there. Then the question will be, how does the centre-left reorganise itself to produce a viable opposition and one day form a government? So when you add all that up together, this is the snap election to end them all, isn't it? In terms of possible results, the permutations, it's absolutely breathtaking. And the next 6 weeks are going to be deeply, deeply absorbing.
The breathtaking Lord Hennessy there. One of the country's veteran pollsters, Peter Kellner, has been briefing me on the changing nature of the voters of Britain.
The British electorate is much more varied in many ways than it was when I was growing up 50 years ago. there are many more swing voters today. Then almost everybody voted either Conservative or Labour, a small number Liberal. There was no real separate politics in Northern Ireland or Scotland. Today, you have a fragmented politics geographically. You have many more parties. Far fewer people have strong party allegiances. And the social and class structure of British society and therefore British politics is utterly different.
And Peter Kellner says swing voters could be influenced by personality as much as policy.
If you ask people today what are the most important issues facing their country, the economic issues around, for example, taxation and prices come a lot lower than they did 20 or 30 years ago. Brexit and immigration come high up, and the health service is always pretty high up. However, the economy will play a significant part in this election, not necessarily directly, but because the swing voters will ask themselves, which party is better for me? That will be implicitly an economic judgment, but it won't be a judgment based on manifesto promises. It'll be what political scientists call a valence judgment. They will ask themselves, which party, which political leaders have the character, have the skills, have the honesty, have the consistency to run the country well and help people like me. If a voter is forced to choose between, remember that old Harry Enfield character, Mr. Nice But Dim, and you pose Mr. Nice But Dim into Nasty But Smart, when push comes to shove, a lot of voters will go for Nasty But Smart rather than Nice But Dim.
Same with radio presenters. Peter Kellner, former president of YouGov. Lots of other programmes will mull over the issues, the manifestos and the strategies. But joining me in the briefing room now are two leading political scientists whose job is to take a broader view and to explain to me the importance of this election at this time. Rosie Campbell is Professor of Politics at Birkbeck College, University of London, and one of her areas of expertise is what voters want from their elected representatives. Professor David Runciman is the host of the Talking Politics podcast, and he also teaches politics and history at Cambridge University, and he's in our Cambridge studio. Let's talk first about this question about who are the voters and voting Britain. Peter Kellner made the point that the electorate's changed radically and there is much less party allegiance than in the past. What do we think? What can we say about the new political tribes of Britain? Rosie Campbell.
I think what was revealed to us during the Brexit referendum, which probably should have been apparent before, is that the divide that David Goodhart describes between the somewheres and the anywheres, which we might think of as perhaps cosmopolitan liberalism versus a more nationalist perspective, is actually much more important in British politics than we realised before, and that's shaping people's attitudes and their behaviour.
This is a taxonomy, I love that word, created by the author David Goodhart. Let's be clear. Who are the somewheres and who are the anywheres?
Well, the somewheres are people who feel attached to their local area, their local community, who are less likely to have a university degree, are more likely to be older. The anywheres are more, they're more liberal, they're more likely to be university educated, to be living in urban populated areas, doing professional jobs.
And presumably so-called because somewheres think somewhere is important and anywheres think anywhere is important.
And they're happy to reside anywhere.
What do you think, David Runciman?
Yeah, I mean, I think Brexit, it was like this X-ray of a country that many people, I would include myself, didn't quite realise we lived in, these divisions that we weren't familiar with. And in addition to the education divide, there was a clear generational divide as well. Older people were more likely to vote Leave, younger people to vote Remain. But I think one of the things that's different about the UK now, say, compared to even the 1970s, we heard about an earlier snap election, we are a much older society. So it's not just that there are two generations. You could say there are three here. I mean, we've got voters in their 20s, voters in their 50s, voters in their 80s who weren't really around, to be honest. I mean, we've aged enormously. And that tension is pulling across party divides. And it's exacerbated by the fact, which is a well-observed feature of politics around the world now, that older people vote more than younger people. And so it's skewed in that way too. So if the generational divide is important, it does also skew the outcome of a whole series of elections, potentially including this one.
What can we say about that? And this is a question to both of you. There was something that used to be called, I recall, the Radio 4 effect, which was essentially that you'd listen to Radio 1 as a youngster, and Radio 4 would always worry that their listeners would all die out. But actually what was happening was when you got to about, let's say, charitably 45, you'd start listening to Radio 4. In other words, people would become their older thing. Or is it the case that younger voters will maintain this sort of different attitude they've got from the older voters and it will gradually supplant the older voters' view? Rosie Campbell.
I think that's the really big unknown. Is this a life cycle effect or a cohort effect? And we can certainly...
Ooh. Explain.
Well, a life cycle effect is what you've described perfectly, that, you know, I start off with Radio 1 and then I start to think, oh, this is a bit noisy, it hurts my ears, I prefer the dulcet tones of Aronovich, and you move on to Radio 4. That would be a life cycle effect, whereas a cohort effect is actually, no, Radio 1 is cool and I'm sticking with it throughout my life. And so we don't know whether the massive changes that have happened since the 1970s in attitudes, whether the younger generation are going to actually continue to be much more liberal and more cosmopolitan, or whether as they find themselves in a post-Brexit world, they actually might start to adhere to some of these values that you're describing that tend to be associated with the older generation.
Dave Runson, what's your instinct on that?
So we're going to put it in these terms. You know, the complication is there's a Radio 2 effect as well. So if you're like me, somewhere in the middle, there are all these people who listen to and share culture and values that cut across that generational divide. And in many ways, I think that's possibly the key demographic for an election like this one. So it's not straightforwardly, I think, that you belong to the young and then you belong to the old, which might have been true, I think, 30 or 40 years ago. And I think it's very hard to track this on the timescale that we would need to see that, how this was going to happen. You know, we'd need to wait 20 or 30 years. And there are people who think, wait 20 or 30 years and the Remainers will be dominant. That's way too long to think about political questions.
We heard Lord Hennessy earlier saying that when you have an election, it is never going to be about one issue alone. And he talked about multiple waves and particles. Do you think that's right?
I think it is right. And certainly the idea that this is a Brexit election or any way of rerunning the referendum can't be true. But it was striking in the examples you had earlier about snap elections, Ramsay MacDonald, Ted Heath. They each made the same pitch that Theresa May is making now, that the choice is strong government, stable government versus, for want of a better word, chaos. It worked for MacDonald, though it didn't work for him personally. It didn't work for Heath. I think the difference now is Theresa May is making it a more acute version of that question. She's saying it's a choice between basically one-party majority government and coalition. And the idea of coalition has become almost a byword for sort of instability, though actually the coalition government of 2010 to 2015 was relatively stable, but it's got a bad reputation. I think that issue will be significant, and I think it will cut across a lot of other issues.
Rosie Campbell.
Well, I think Theresa May has to pose this stability versus chaos and coalition, because she has to explain why you shouldn't vote for the other side, even though it's pretty obvious, at least the polls are right, that she's going to do extremely well. And I think that must be about turnout, because the polls would suggest that they don't really need to attack Labour and a coalition that hard. But we've had some very close elections recently, 2010, 2015, the referendum. We forget that turnout was on a serious decline before that. And they must be concerned that an election that looks like a foregone conclusion is one where many fewer people turn out and vote. And that's when unexpected things might start to happen in some constituencies.
You said that the expectation, the anticipation is that Theresa May is likely, and all the polls show it, to get an increased majority. What kind of impact would that have, David Runciman, on the type of Brexit we have?
Well, she'll make a manifesto commitment to a certain kind of Brexit, and if she gets a big majority, it will be an endorsement of that. But really, it's an endorsement of a negotiating strategy, and negotiation can go lots of different ways. I think what we will find is that the size of the majority and her internal party dynamics and the management issues that she faces either give her a more or less free hand to negotiate. I don't think a very large majority binds her to a particular strategy come hell or high water, but she certainly seems to be someone who likes to stick to her lines. And so I suspect a large majority will persuade her that she does need to deliver on what she offered in her manifesto.
OK, well, we haven't seen that manifesto yet.
No.
So here's the next question to both of you. Given what we've said about somewheres, anywheres and so on, what kind of Britain do we imagine Theresa May envisages? I mean, is she with the kind of globalisers and the market capitalists, or is she with the traditionalists and the somewheres? Rosie Campbell, I mean, you can't look inside her head, but from what we've seen so far,
I think she's very strongly aligning herself with the Somewheres, and she has a sense of wanting to foster community and local kind of civic values. And she, as a politician, hasn't actually had to rub shoulders with the market all that much. I'm very interested...
Because she's been Home Secretary rather than Chancellor.
Yes, yeah. And so she hasn't been under an enormous amount of pressure from big business. So I think that is what she imagines. Whether once those interests start combining forces against her, whether her imagination might shift a little bit, I'm not sure.
Well, David Runciman, let's say that she was looking at a less cosmopolitan Toryism. What might you expect to find that consisting of? I mean, she's already talked about the European Court of Human Rights and wanting to get out of it. There's the question raised this week by Bill Gates about foreign aid. And, of course, there's always the question about immigration.
Yeah, I mean, the foreign aid one is interesting because it's a classic totemic issue for this question. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that voters often think that the foreign aid budget is much bigger than it actually is. And now we've got to focus on the fact it is only 0.7%. And yet here we have a prime minister who may be wanting to argue that that's too much. I think there will be lots of symbolic politics around these sort of somewhere questions. And immigration is another one. To reach the target will be very important.
OK, so let's look at the other side of that question, Rosie Campbell. If Labour collapses and ceases to be a viable opposition, as Lord Hennessy suggested, he was talking about the standard model and it going, what effect would that have on British politics?
Well, in the immediate term, a massive effect. If Labour completely collapses and we have a Conservative landslide, between now and 2022, all of the pressure Theresa May will face will be from the right. And I think things like the 0.7 on aid, that's actually about saying, if we're going to make substantial cuts elsewhere, if we're going to take the triple lock off pensions, we can't continue to seem to be generous to people abroad. And that, I think that's what we will see if there's no pressure from the left. That makes sense.
And David Runciman.
I think one of the striking things here is that the British electoral system, our first-past-the-post system, if anything, I think it artificially inflates the strength of the Labour position. If you look at other European countries, you look at France at the moment, their French presidential election. If you look at the recent vote in the Netherlands, the mainstream Social Democratic Party has collapsed. I mean, it's off the table. Whereas in this country, there is still only one viable party of opposition after this election. It will still be Labour. I mean, the question is, at what point even the British electoral system can no longer prop Labour up? And then we're in a wholly new game, and we may need a new electoral system.
I know this is a terrible question, but would you expect there to be big efforts to form a new party of the centre-left?
I think the great barrier has always been first past the post. Had we some form of proportional representation, I think it's almost certainly the case now that Labour would have split. The Conservatives might have split too. Under first past the post, the incentives are so skewed against, and historical experience, taking this leap in the dark. But at some point, the British system does not work without an alternative government in waiting. And if we genuinely do not have one, all of the parties of opposition may realise that they've got to, if not form a new party, create a new system that allows them to form a new party. But it's very hard to kind of work out how you get from here to there.
What does that mean for the kind of people who've traditionally felt themselves represented by centre-left parties and felt their interests represented by them?
I think, at least in this election, it's going to be very hard for people like that to feel represented in any way. I mean, especially if you think 48% of the population voted Remain, only the Liberal Democrats is really taking even a partial Remain position.
Outside Scotland.
Yes, outside of Scotland. Anyone on the left probably is feeling pretty disenfranchised, and I can only personally think that that's probably likely to continue and accelerate.
And there will be other disenfranchised groups if you are a Scottish voter. I mean, we have to remember that significant numbers of Scots voted for Brexit. Mm-hmm. And if you are a pro-Brexit Scot, your choices are relatively limited. If you're a pro-union Scot, your choices are relatively limited. I mean, I think this election will produce whole swathes of people who feel they didn't have anyone to vote for.
Now, we've mentioned Scotland, and it is the most important because they vote for, overwhelmingly, a party, or a party gets represented, that's at variance with what you get UK-wide. How's that nationalist argument going to play out in the circumstances of a Conservative large majority, David?
I think we have the same issue, which is if you make the election about a single issue, it doesn't work. So if it's Brexit in certain parts of the UK, i.e. England, if it's about Scottish independence in Scotland, that doesn't settle anything. It's, if anything, simply adding something to a negotiating strategy. There's a game of high-stakes poker going on between Nicola Sturgeon and Theresa May about the second independence referendum. It's impossible to see any result of this election settling that game. What it will do is simply give someone a few more chips, someone a few less chips, and it will play out. There is no way that you can ask in a constituency-based general election a question like, do you want another independence referendum? There either will be one or there won't be one, but this election will not decide that.
And can I just ask a very brief question, push on that, which is, let's say the SNP's number of seats goes down slightly. Could that be represented? Because they won almost all the seats.
Yeah, it's hard for them to go up.
It's very hard for them to go up. If they go down at all, which seems quite likely, couldn't that be argued as a rebuff to independence?
It could. And also, there is the possibility that the Conservatives will revive somewhat in Scotland. It's hard for them to win many seats, as they may do also in Wales. And whereas Labour, I think, almost certainly won't in Scotland. So if there does come a rebuff to the SNP, it will strengthen Theresa May's hand, no question.
I agree with that wholeheartedly, in that Nicola Sturgeon probably would have preferred to sit with her 56 seats and watch the country be run by the Conservatives for a bit longer. And losing seats would set her back a few paces, but she would still be in Scotland with an overwhelming SNP majority of MPs being run by a Conservative government in Westminster, which would be very unpopular with the Scots, which will do her good in the long term. So I think, yes, I agree with you about the chips moving around, but the direction still would seem to be moving towards independence, I think.
And something else that makes this election unique in any historical perspective, we're talking about Nicola Sturgeon and what she'll do after this general election. Well, she won't be in the House of Commons. And that, of course, is different from many of these other scenarios that we talked about, because devolution has already completely changed the dynamics of British politics. The leader of the party, who will probably form, in a way, the most significant opposition to, let's assume, a Theresa May government, will not be leading that opposition from the Commons.
OK. We're used to the cliche now because of Brexit. People say they didn't expect it, although the polls are actually closer than that, mostly because of Donald Trump and so on, that we must expect the unexpected. So I'm going to ask you both, what is the thing that people are not expecting that you are most expecting?
I'll go second. Come on.
Oh, no, I've got to think that we are expecting all that we think is possible, because they're quite different.
Well, what do you think that we're not looking at the moment that might happen?
Let me have a go at answering that. I mean, I do think that the polls are likely to be misleading for some of the reasons that we've talked about, which is that we're not talking about national swings. London votes one way, the South votes another way, North Wales votes differently from South Wales, Scotland is another country, Northern Ireland is a totally separate polity. So a 22-24 point lead for the Tories doesn't, as it might have done 30 or 4 years ago, just map out as a wave. I think people who are expecting a big Tory poll lead to straightforwardly translate into huge numbers of seats will be mistaken. I mean, I think it's very unlikely that the Conservatives will lose their majority. But I think there will possibly be a mismatch, and it relates to what I said before about Labour's artificially inflated position, between what looks like a Labour wipeout and a House of Commons, which is not maybe hugely different from the one at the moment.
Rosie Campbell.
Well, I think it's unlikely, because I think that the proportion of the electorate who very, very strongly remain, most of the survey evidence suggests about 22%, so it's not significant enough, you know. But I suppose the unexpected that could happen is that that becomes much more of a galvanising identity than we think, and the Liberal Democrats really actually do very well. I still think it's pretty unlikely.
Well, that's all for this episode of The Briefing Room. I'd like to thank my guests, Lord Hennessy, Peter Kellner, Rosie Campbell and David Runciman. The Briefing Room will be back next week, when we'll be looking at the escalating situation in North Korea, barring another major news event. Until then, good night. That's all from The Briefing Room this week. My producers were China Collins and Javier Zabata. If you'd like to listen to the programme on Radio 4, we're on Thursdays at 8 o'clock in the evening, UK time. And if you'd like to let us know what you think about the series, there's an easy way to do it. Just write a review or ratings on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments. If you're looking for other quality podcasts, search for 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy, a programme about inventions, ideas and innovations which help create the economic world we live in.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.